Washing the Market podcast. I'm host Bill Ullman, and I'm so happy to welcome Rhianne Horgan to the studio today. After a stellar 16-year run at J.P. Morgan's wealth management business, Rhianne took that all-important leap into entrepreneurship, founding in 2017 a fintech company called Kinder, a company that is helping baby boomers prepare financially for their retirement years. Rhianne is a graduate of the College of William & Mary, where she studied finance and public policy, and where she also serves as trustee of the William & Mary Foundation. Welcome, Rhianne.
Thanks so much, Bill, for having me today.
Rhianne, let's start with your journey into entrepreneurship, into retirement business, into starting this incredible new fintech company here in New York City.
So founding Kinder was really kind of two parts of my life coming together. The first was what I was seeing at J.P. Morgan, and the second actually was this decades-long conversation I had been having with my father about retirement. When I was at J.P. Morgan in my last couple of years, I had the opportunity to work with a number of the marketplaces who were coming to the banks looking for capital to really fund their platforms. And I would be in these conversations where they wanted to get capital from the bank. And I instead was more intrigued by the user design. I was all of a sudden seeing for the first time how, you know, complex financial products could be made so much easier for the user to understand. So that was, I'd say, like in the business life, seeing this change in technology and how we could make financial products easier. On the other side, it was this like decades-long conversation with my father that really was the kind of the kernel of the start of Kinder.
Did you work with a lot of retirees when you were at J.P. Morgan? Were you aware of the range of products out there?
When I was at J.P. Morgan, I was working with a lot of individual investors. And to be frank, you know, those customers tended to have a lot more money than my customers today. And so, you know, things like Social Security or fear of running out of money in retirement really weren't the issues they were focused on. They were probably more focused on legacy planning. And it was actually this conversation with my father that really helped me to understand like the complexity of the government benefit system, you know, this challenge of living longer and what it really meant for like the average American.
And it's a tough spot for the average American today. Do you have some stats around that just to set the table here?
Yeah. So look, I think kind of the most important thing I would think about today is that, you know, more than 80% of our customers don't have a pension. Baby boomers are likely to live 10 years longer than their parents. And when they started saving for retirement, they thought they would probably have a pension. They didn't think they were going to live as long. And now it's like DIY, figure it out yourself. We hope you make it.
So understanding the market and having this great experience at J.P. Morgan is one thing. Making the leap to entrepreneurship is another. That's a big step off of, let's just say, a gravy train of J.P. Morgan, of a great job, a great career, a great path forward. You decide, I'm going to roll the dice. I have to raise money. I have to go through all this process. Talk about that thinking, that challenge. What made you do it? How'd you get prepared for it?
Yeah, look, it was a huge change. And I think I probably didn't realize that at the time, to be very honest. You know, a couple of years in, I would actually say this is much harder than any job I've ever had in my career. But it's also much more rewarding. And so I think that for me is what keeps me really focused every day was like, we know, you know, our team of 16 people, you know, we're helping our own parents ensure that they can retire fearlessly. I think for me, you know, there were two things that were really important in the early days. The first was going out and really doing user research. And so I became a real big believer of user-centric design. And it was just through a network and technology that I got introduced to a number of people who helped me do some of my early user research. And frankly, a lot of my initial theses were proved wrong through that user research.
Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, like you're going to anchor in the early days around problems you know. And so very selfishly in the conversations I was having with my parents, I was thinking about like myself becoming the caregiver and some of the challenges that a caregiver will face over time when it comes to helping mom and dad with their finances. What I realized when we did some early user research was actually, you know, the vast majority of the time the caregiver spends is around healthcare, not really about finances. There's definitely some challenges there, but the real interest on the caregiver side is around making sure that mom and dad, you know, have, you know, solid health care and are comfortable. And in that journey, though, what we found was that the caregivers who were typically in their 50s and 60s started reflecting on themselves. And that actually, the conversations with them about their retirement is actually what led us to where we are today.
You're clearly tackling one of the largest and most important financial problems in America, saving for retirement and having enough money to last what are becoming longer and longer lifespans. How does Kinder do this better or help people do this better than other companies that are out there. There's plenty of annuity providers, banks, brokerage companies, other financial institutions helping people do this today. How does Kinder do it?
So the first thing is that we're exclusively built for baby boomers. So we have one goal at Kinder, which is to make sure that our baby boomers' customers' savings outlive their bucket list. So all we think about all day long is this demographic. Second thing is that from the beginning, we knew that we wanted to be able to address the retirement conundrum holistically. So as you mentioned, there are some great annuity providers, there are some great ETF companies, there are some great financial planners, but typically a customer has to make each of these decisions individually, and they're left themselves to be the general practitioner to pull all the pieces of the puzzle together. Our goal at Kinder is to actually be that GP and bring all the pieces together, not be biased by commissions. And so we are agnostic to how we build the product from kind of a financial perspective. What we're really focused on is, does this solution solve the customer's goals? And that, I think, is very different to how the industry is built today, which is very siloed, lots of different fee mechanisms, and frankly, a pretty old style kind of engagement model, which requires you to like get in your car, drive 20 minutes to a financial advisor, spend time there, get a 30-page document, and really kind of keep going back and forth like that.
Is there a big gulf within the baby boomer community about facility with technology and ability to access your company? Do you worry about that?
So I think that there is a real misunderstanding in the tech community about this demographics usage of technology. It's different than, I have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old. So like my 5- and 7-year-old swipe and touch everything. They had their profiles on Disney Plus ready within seconds of it launching. And like they interact with technology differently than me. And then my dad interacts with technology differently than me. And so what we spend a lot of time at Kinder doing is meeting our customers where they are, which is most of our traffic is mobile, but our customers navigate a little bit differently. They like more of a guided journey than a choose your own adventure, which is very typical in a millennial focused app, the kind of swipe left, swipe right, figure it out. They also like to read a lot more than look at pictures. And so, we have made sure that our user interface has a lot more text and is giving this demographic the content they're looking to support their decisions.
So, Rianne, Congress finally did something. They passed the quote-unquote Secure Act recently. It hasn't been signed by the president yet, is expected to be. Talk about that act and what it means for the retirement industry overall and maybe for Kinder as well.
So the Secure Act is, we think, the most comprehensive piece of retirement legislation we've seen in decades. It's finally a sign from the government of recognizing that retirement has changed. We're living longer. We've got to save ourselves, and it's much more expensive. So what you see in the Secure Act are a number of different things that kind of pull that together. So the first is a real focus on retirement income, really encouraging plan sponsors to help the consumer understand how much income they'll get from their retirement savings. You see a recognition that more of us are working for small businesses and there are more part-time workers. And so encouraging small businesses to band together to provide retirement plans, part-time employees having a greater opportunity to contribute to retirement accounts. And then to the living longer, what you see is that it used to be in the old days that after the age of 70 and a half, you couldn't contribute to an IRA anymore. You can now do that. You also are allowed to push off taking out your minimum distributions from your retirement account to 72 rather than 70 and a half. That part of the equation, just to give a little bit more color, for most of probably your audience, Bill, they're probably still putting money into their savings accounts. But starting at age 70 and a half today, the government says, knocks on your door and says, you got to start taking money out, like we want our taxes. So this new legislation pushes it back to 72, which is great. There is, of course, a cost for all of this. So there's no free lunch and, how this bill is being funded is by the elimination of the stretch IRA. Used to be that you could give your kids an IRA as an inheritance, and they could take out money out of that account over their lifetime using their ages and basically defer the RMDs for a long period of time.
RMDs being required.
Minimum distributions, right. Exactly. Now the government is saying that's too much, like we need our tax money faster. So you have 10 years to take the money out. The implications there are a couple things. The first is that it may be more tax efficient to actually give money to your spouse first and then kids so that you can kind of elongate how long the compounding is going on for. The second thing is that you really need to be thoughtful about what the tax implication on your children are. It may, you know, the, an inheritance may, being spread out over this short period of time, may bump up their own tax rates. And so really just trying to think about, like, now you've got to factor in not only your taxes, but their taxes as you make this estate planning decisions.
And what about the impact on your company, on Kinder? Does this change what you're doing? Does it impact you in any way?
Look, we see this as a reaffirmation that we have to really modernize retirement in America. So we're really excited to see, you know, the government finally stepping up and saying things have changed. And so, you know, from the beginning, we've been really focused on retirement income. We've been focused on helping Americans very tax efficiently take money out of their accounts. Our Smart Draw software does those RMD calculations for customers. It'll actually be even more complicated going forward because you'll have, you know, if you inherited an IRA a few years ago, you'll be grandfathered into the old rules, but your own accounts will be subject to the new rules. And so there's a lot of like math that has to get done that, you know, we're excited about using software just to make it really simple for our customers.
Retirement since the global financial crisis, I'm going to make an assumption, has gotten more difficult. Obviously, the demographic trends are people living longer, but also we're in a low interest rate environment since then, which puts a lot of pressure, particularly on fixed income oriented investors. Talk about the building blocks of a complete retirement plan. What should people be thinking about? What are the things they need to put in place to fund their retirement effectively?
So the framework that we use is all around income-based planning and really comes together in a paycheck. And, you know, I think about all of us in this room today, like we've had a paycheck for a long period of time, and it actually creates a mental model that helps us make decisions every single day. In a world without pensions, we actually are saying to customers, you need a new mental model. You need to like look at a balance sheet and try to figure out how do you take that nest egg of $500,000 or $1 million and spend it down. And that's really confusing for the
and is
customer.
Is that your customer, that $500,000 to $1.5 million range? Is that
that's the core customer is in that range. Like they've been doing the right thing. They've been saving for retirement. They probably bought a house in the 80s. You know, a third of their net worth is typically tied up in their home and the rest is in retirement savings. But that customer, the vast majority of them don't have a pension. And if they have a pension, it tends to be a partial pension. As a household, they're probably getting, you know, between like $3,000 to $3,400 worth of Social Security income, so material Social Security income. But what we see is that Social Security income, which really is an annuity, doesn't typically cover their essential spending, so their house, their taxes, their healthcare costs. And so we're big believers in using annuities as a way to complement the retirement income that you have. So if you don't have a pension or you don't have part-time income, using an annuity to top up your Social Security. And then for your discretionary spending, just pulling down on your marketable securities. The way we think about it is you want to always know that your essentials are covered, whether you live to 80, 90, or 100, but you can pull back on some of the spending, and that's the discretionary. So you don't have to go on that trip every single year or, you know, the holiday gifts, you can kind of think a little bit differently in a tough year.
So Social Security plus an annuity, the income thrown off by those two things covers your essentials, your living, your housing, and then dividends and interest from your other investments, plus maybe selling some of those investments, covers the discretionary.
Yeah, and I would say for our customers, they're going to need to draw down on those savings, so it won't just be dividends and interest. And so we've spent a lot of time actually building software that helps them very tax efficiently draw down on their assets over time. So, you know, it's the holidays. I think about, you know, you need to take out $1,000 of cash to spend on holiday gifts. The question is, do you take it out of your Roth, your taxable account, or your IRA? And the answer is, it depends. It depends on a lot of different factors. And that's actually what's really fun is that we've built a whole bunch of software that takes all those factors into account and actually gives customers recommendations every month on which account to take money out of.
Talk about that, because I've been to your website and you have a planning tool on your website. Is this what the software is driving?
Yeah, so we have a planning tool that's really income-based that really helps customers figure out like what their retirement income looks like. Behind that plan, we have a software called Smart Draw that is all about designing for longevity.
And you've built that
software. We've built that ourselves. And
so
it was
that's proprietary.
Proprietary software. And, you know, the first thing you see from Smart Draw on a plan is it helps you figure out how long your money is going to last. Once you get into retirement, however, you actually have to start doing this mental calculus every month on like which account do I take money from. So the software we've built there actually gives customers recommendations every month on which account to pull from. For a customer with $1 million nest egg, it saves them on average $61,000 over the course of retirement. So these decisions are actually really, really costly. And what we find is that most people are using kind of old school rules of thumb that actually may not be giving them the right recommendation.
Talk about annuities for a second. That's a part of this planning process. Annuities over the years have gotten a bad rap, high commissions, aggressive agents, things like that. How do you approach the annuity business, and how is what you're doing different than the typical person maybe talking to their insurance broker or their registered rep at a financial firm?
So the first thing is, you mentioned earlier that I worked at JP Morgan. So I had no background in annuities or insurance before starting Kinder. And so what drove me to look for an annuity partner was this constant fear of running out of money that I heard from my customers. And I knew that like the 95% probability conversation that us, you know, former bankers could have with a customer just wasn't going to give my customers the peace of mind they needed. And that an annuity is just like Social Security. It's just like a pension. It's just backed by an insurance company. But when I started pulling back the covers on the annuity, what I saw was a couple things. I saw a lot of complexity to the products. Like the features were really difficult for me even to understand.
Talk about some of the different, there's fixed annuities, there's variable annuities just to start.
Yeah, fixed variable, you know, whether or not you're going to have a death benefit, what the underlying market assumptions are. And by the way, I grew up at JP Morgan in the derivatives business. And so one of the first things we actually did with American Equity, who is our carrier partner, is that we unbundled the annuity and priced every single feature. Once I knew what each feature cost, then I was able to make a decision around like, do I actually think that this feature is valuable for our customers? And so we then rebuilt the product together with the features that we felt were price appropriate for the risks of the customers, you know, we're looking to take. The second thing that you see in the annuity industry is that the vast majority of the industry is commission based, and for us at Kinder, we wanted to truly be agnostic between whether the portfolio had ETFs or annuities or whatever combination. And so everything at Kinder has no commission. We fee on an account level basis on an annual, you know, it's between 0.25 and 0.5% per annum. And that, I think, at the time, I met 40 insurance companies before I found one who was willing to provide us with this no commission product.
Well, that just tells you everything about the industry right there.
Well, and talk about having doubt as an entrepreneur. So we talked about the entrepreneurial journey. By the time, you know, you've had 40 no's, you start to get a little bit nervous about like, can you actually deliver this value prop? But we were really lucky to find a very forward thinking team at American Equity to partner with us.
Incredible. Talk about funding Kinder. You came up with this idea, you're in it. I assume your own time, sweat equity, maybe some of your own money as well. But to really hire 16 people, build software, do all of that, you need capital to do that. Talk about that part of the entrepreneurial journey, the capital raising. How do you think about valuation? How do you reach all these people to raise the money? All of that.
Yeah, so in the earliest days, I did self-fund the business. And so I had that flexibility having been working for a long time to be able to give myself that runway to do some of the early user research and really come to the market with a much more developed thesis and insights on the customer, which I think was really helpful. Along that journey, I had actually met some VCs through my conversations at JP Morgan. And one of the venture capitalists I had met was a gentleman named Sean Park, who's the founder of Anthemis. Sean is known for being early. You know, he invested in companies like Currency Cloud, like Betterment in their very earliest days. He himself was in his late 40s and kind of understood like this conundrum of retirement. He also and his firm have also, I think, been really good about backing non-traditional founders. So I don't look like your typical kind of Y Combinator founder, right? I had been working for 17 years. I had, God forbid, only worked at one company. And I actually was a sole founder. And that like, profile actually makes it a little tricky to raise capital. But what I found in Sean was someone who his company and his VC arm was able to bring a lot of tech DNA to the table to really complement my domain experience. And together, we actually worked together for 6 months and kind of incubated the idea together. And they really helped me then get it off the ground, helped me recruit my CTO. And from then on, you know, the conversation became a little bit easier because we had the foundational pieces that other investors were looking for.
And it is part of that advantage having Anthemis itself as an investor because that sends a signal to other quality investors. Is that?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, our investors to date have been predominantly focused on the fintech and insurtech space. I would say that when I think about decisions that we made that were non-typical, but that our existing investor base really understood was a couple things. So the first was that our fourth full-time hire was a general counsel.
Is that a function of being in a highly regulated
business? We're highly regulated. Look, we're an SEC registered investment advisor. We're licensed as an insurance agency in all 50 states. SEC did an exam before we went live. Like, we don't want to mess around with that stuff. And so we brought in a legit general counsel as our fourth employee. Our third employee was a designer, a user designer. And so if I go back to the origins of the story, like, I realized that I was wrong really early on in like what I thought I was going to build, and saw that importance of actually having designers early on. And I think our investors, like, that is like that fact pattern of like CTO, designer, and then GC is probably not the typical. It's typically like hire tons of engineers and get going. And our investors really got that this is a lot of white space that no one has really figured out already, and you have to think differently in how you attack it.
Margaret Hartigan of Marstone was on earlier, and her co-founder is a designer, which is kind of an interesting comparison with your company. When we think about retirement, what people are thinking about at age 70, very different than age 50, very different than age 25. Can you just give people at those three points, what are the things they should be thinking about at those points in life?
Yeah, so at age 25, and I share this with people on our team, like my, you know, because we have 25-year-olds on our team. It's like the power of time, right? So saving, just start saving. If you can start saving, and we, even as a startup, very early on started making contributions to our employees' 401ks. You know, that again is probably non-traditional, but given the problem we're solving for our customers, was really important to me, and I want to give my employees that ability to save over time. I think in the 50s, and we see this a lot with our customers, is there is this chance for course correction. Depending on, if you have kids, depending on what age you have kids, it may be a time that, you know, the kids are now out of college and now you get to refocus on yourself. If you're like me, I had kids later in life, and so I'm still going to be paying those tuition bills in my 50s. But what you find by the age of 50 is you've probably had a bunch of different jobs. Your accounts are probably all over the place. It's a perfect time to think about consolidation, simplification, and then really to start to understand how a couple decisions like retiring 2 years later or taking Social Security at 67 rather than 62 can materially change the outcome. And so just getting yourself in the mindset of being a little bit flexible about the exact date you retire. In your 70s, you've probably made a lot of the decisions. The first thing we think about is this, like, be tax aware as you take money out of your accounts. Like, Uncle Sam is coming for you. He wants your money. Don't give him too much. The second thing we think about, though, is be creative in how you create retirement income. I love what's happening with, like, the gig economy. Women in their 50s and 60s are the most successful hosts on Airbnb. If I get outside of New York City, what I find is actually a large percentage of my Uber drivers are retired. And so I think in your 70s, you know, what we find is that many retirees actually don't enjoy being at home all day, or they actually don't want to play golf 24/7. They want to play a bit of golf, but they're trying to find purpose in their life. And if you can find purpose that actually pays you, that can be really interesting.
Fantastic advice. Squashing the Market has featured, and we're proud to feature, several women on this series who are in fintech, in finance, in technology. Can you talk about your journey as a woman at JP Morgan in a big financial institution, as well as an entrepreneur starting a company here in New York City? Two industries typically dominated by men, tougher path for women. Talk about how being a woman in this world has influenced what you're doing and the success you've had.
Yeah. So look, the first thing I'd say is that I was really fortunate in my career at JP Morgan to have a lot of champions, which really led to my success at the firm. I also, my very first boss was a woman who had three young boys who was a managing director. So I'll tell you, when I started at JP Morgan, I didn't really think about myself any differently than my male colleagues. I had this very successful manager and mentor who seemed to have, like, figured it all out. I did move to Europe a couple years in, and that was, like, fascinating because I think at the time in the 90s in Europe, like, you didn't see as many women engaged in financial services. And that was probably, like, the first time where I kind of started to feel like maybe I stood out a little bit. At the end of the day, like, I think, you know, one of the core focuses at Kinder is being human in a world that sees numbers. And I think that actually, for me as a woman, has helped me differentiate how we approach building products or solving customer problems. Like, there's an empathy that I feel like I've brought to the table that has helped me to build really customer-centric products. In the transition into fintech, I felt like I had this really great opportunity that I was building a company from scratch. And you had the ability to build it right. And so, you know, today, half of our engineers are female, half of our management team is female. My CTO is from the Caribbean. Like, we have been very purposeful about diversity. It isn't easy. It isn't easy even as a woman to be purposeful about diversity because you want to move fast. You want to make quick decisions and, you know, who you hire. You want, when you're trying to hire fast, and I'll like, for example, when I post a job on LinkedIn for like a financial related role, I get an applicant base that is, you know, 95% white men. And so if I'm going to use that as my hiring base and I'm going to have a certain outcome, we have to be prepared as founders to move a little bit slower if we want to be purposeful about how we hire. And that is challenging because you have this race against time, but it's something that our whole leadership team has been committed to from the beginning. And we hope that it makes it a better place to work for our employees.
You're a CEO of a company, even though relatively small as companies go, but talk about what are the values and the culture that you're trying to create and imbue within in the employees in your organization. What's important to you in terms of management?
So a couple of the core values at Kinder include, the first I'd say is being human in a world that sees numbers. We are solving financial problems, but they're really human problems. And we have to figure out how do we take things that are really complicated and make it easy for a customer to understand and for the customer to feel empowered. And so like not being too overly financially wonky is really important. Second, we've talked about this already, but we think about diversity as our best chance of building things differently. Like we're building for a different customer base. We're not building for 22-year-olds or 25-year-olds or 30-year-olds. And so we already see that, you know, on a day-to-day basis and thinking about like diverse perspectives, diverse backgrounds and building the company. And then the, you know, giving the customer choice is super important to us. You know, this is not a one-size-fits-all solution. You know, everyone has different goals for retirement and really making sure that, you know, we are giving customers that ability to solve for their retirement and not feel like they're being forced into kind of our view.
One of the things we do on Squash in the Market is talk about the investment strategies of the people who come on the show. What are they doing with their money, with their savings, with their retirements? How do they think about it? How do they organize it? Talk for a moment about your own personal financial journey and what are you doing with your money these days?
For my own portfolio, it's a little bit barbelled, right? And this is different than it would have been when I was still at JP Morgan. So I'd say when I was at JP Morgan, I would have had a more traditional portfolio where I'd have been more fully invested. You know, I would have had JP Morgan stock. I had my retirement accounts and any savings were really in like a balanced portfolio. You know, today what I have is my ownership in Kinder, which is, you know, a large portion of my own personal net worth, frankly, barbell that against cash on one hand. And then in my retirement accounts, I'm fully invested. And so that's where I'm, you know, we believe like my accounts are with Kinder. I'm in 90% stocks, 10% bonds, and, you know, I have time on my side. And that is like kind of my growth asset. But I do think as an entrepreneur, you know, the thing that I'm excited about going forward is starting to get more involved in investing in other startups and starting to, you know, get involved with that at the early stage and help other founders get off the ground to something that, you know, now that I have some cash on the side, starting to take a pool of that to make some investments.
Fantastic. So the last thing we do on the Squashing the Market podcast is what we call our lightning round. I'm going to give you pairs of words, and you just need to choose one, but you don't even need to say why. So here we go. Amazon or Google?
Google.
ETFs or mutual funds?
ETFs.
Low fees or high net returns?
High net returns.
Fixed income or equity?
That's a tough one. Going to go with equity.
Baby boomers or millennials?
Absolutely baby boomers.
Regular IRA or Roth IRA?
Roth.
Hedge funds or venture capital?
Venture.
Silicon Valley or Silicon Alley?
Silicon Alley.
And on that note, thank you, Rianne Horgan, for joining Squashing the Market podcast.